morning is Ambrose against Holmes.
May it please the court, I represent appellant Richard Ambrose. There are two issues for consideration by this court today. The first is whether Mr. Ambrose is being held in violation of his due process rights by the state of Illinois. The question here is the gatekeeping issue. It's whether or not the state proved before the state court that Mr. Ambrose is the type of individual who is more appropriately dealt with as a civil, not criminal offender, and thus incarcerated for an indeterminate amount of time with less procedural protections.
But maybe you could take the other issue first that we asked you to look at, namely procedural default, because I'll tell you the thing that I'm concerned about two things with respect to procedural default. First, the fact that the point about Hendricks arises only in a reply brief before the state appellate court, under circumstances where we often have said, and the Illinois courts follow the same rule, that that's too late to raise something. And secondly, even if you thought for some reason that was fine, or maybe the state court didn't say anything about how late it was, the discussion, to put it mildly, is cursory. I mean, it's awfully hard to see this as giving the state court fair notice that this is the theory he's relying on.
Well, our position is it was in a reply brief, and if the state appellate court had ruled that it was procedurally defaulted because it was in a reply brief, then we wouldn't be here today making this argument. The state court clearly has that authority under current jurisprudence, but the state court didn't do that.
For all we know, they didn't even know it was there, which is
sure. We agree. They may not have known it was there. They may have known it was there and chosen not to address it because it was a valid argument. And the problem for this panel is that you can't know the basis that the state court made its decision not to include anything about it in the record. And because you can't know, and because Mr. Ambrose is currently in detention, and because no court, no jury has ever ruled upon whether or not he has a volitional incapacity, whether or not he can't control himself, that's a serious constitutional right on the line. He is currently incarcerated. And this court can't say, well, the state court may have gotten it right. Further, there is a doctrine in Illinois under People versus Bryan that constitutional issues can be raised at any time, even in a reply brief.
So why did he drop? I mean, maybe you don't know this. It's probably an unfair question to ask you. If that's the case, then it seems, with hindsight, a very strange decision for him to have dropped this ancillary proceeding that was going along, and the district court judge here did exactly what this court has recommended. She stayed the proceedings. He wasn't going to lose his filing date. He was going to be able to pick up, and all of a sudden it goes away.
Well,
that seems too bad.
That's true, Your Honor, and I in point of fact, do not know why he's wrong.
I know you didn't tell him to do it, because I remember when you got in the case.
That's true.
There it is.
From speaking to him, frankly, I believe that he dropped it because over a year had passed without anything happening as a result of it. He filed it in 2002 in January, and as of January of 2003, there had not been a briefing schedule set by the court. There had been no pronouncement by the court. There had been nothing submitted by the state in response to it. And frankly, I think Mr. Ambrose saw the movement that was happening at the district court level and that he was actually getting attention, that the state was being asked to answer, and thought, well, my best bet is with a court that at least has some movement. Now, I don't know that to be true.
So do you have any, given the fact that he withdrew it, I mean, do you have any authority that helps your client in terms of our review?
Right. I don't think that that motion that he filed should be relevant to this court at all. I don't think you should think about it. That's not our basis for presentment to the state, to the Illinois State Court. We're saying he presented it in his reply brief, and that presentation
but
is
then
sufficient.
When he referred to Hendricks in the reply brief, it was in the context of his argument surrounding his belief that the psychiatrist had inadequate support for their diagnosis.
That's true.
That was the context in which that case was discussed. So
that's true.
You can raise a constitution. I mean, he can make some reference to a constitutional issue. So he cited the case, but doesn't he have to give the court an idea of where he's going? And indeed, he did here.
Well, he did here,
as it relates to the, the diagnosis.
That's true, but in that reply brief, he also references the fact that it rises to a level of constitutionality when, and maybe I can find you the exact language that we quoted in our brief, Mr. Amber said that the incapacity to control rather than the failure to control dangerous behavior, the mental disorder elements gain constitutional significance when it becomes an uncontrollable impulse and is no longer an impulse not controlled. And goes on to cite Hendricks a couple of times, talks about the United States Supreme Court, and that's a lot of reference to this issue, an issue that is at the heart of constitutional litigation on this subject when dealing with sexually dangerous persons and the civil confinement of them. And remember, with respect to Mr. Ambrose, we're talking about an individual who has never even been charged before with anything relating to sexual dangerousness. This is his first time doing it, and the state isn't even proving that in his first time he is a dangerous person that is more appropriately dealt with in a civil matter. Now, our argument is, it's in the reply brief. The state agrees that they're not arguing that there's an independent state procedural basis for the dismissal. They gave up on that in their response brief. So what you have to analyze as a panel is whether or not there is a fair presentment there, whether or not that panel could have had any idea based on what Mr. Ambrose put in his reply brief that he was bringing about a constitutional challenge. And frankly, this court in several cases has found much more attenuated presentation of the state court to meet fair presentment requirements. Virgin versus O'Leary, the petitioner there never referred to the constitutional nature of his claim.
If the Supreme Court disapproved our doctrine earlier this term, does it make any difference? The Supreme Court rejected the prevailing Seventh Circuit doctrine in Baldwin against Reese.
I was unaware of that, Your Honor.
It was early March, March 3rd or something like that, but in Baldwin against Reese, the court, I think it's fair to say, not that they single out the Seventh Circuit necessarily, but
many other circuits too.
They did make it clear that fair presentment requires a pretty upfront presentation of the issue in the petition itself. They said the state courts didn't have to dig through, lower court opinions and all sorts of things. Actually, kind of a funny tone to it. We don't want to read, but it is a heightening of the standard. I don't think we can think about fair presentment without taking Baldwin into account.
Sure. Well, our argument then would be, Your Honor, that
and to finish up, it seems very unlikely that under Baldwin's understanding of fair presentment, something that first is raised in a pro se reply brief in a case where he had counsel would be viewed as fair presentment. A lot of courts don't even read pro se filings in a case where there's counsel.
Well, but he didn't exactly have counsel.
But it was an Anders brief, wasn't it?
Right.
It was just the one time
counsel
that you
filed an Anders brief.
The pro se brief.
Right, right. At the point where the reply brief was filed, Mr. Ambrose was the only person trying to address his incarceration. His counsel had sort of fled the jurisdiction on it, said we don't have any issues, and left. And frankly, in the reply brief, it's a nine-page document. It's a nine-page document in which an entire page is devoted, a bottom half of one page, to an entire first half and another one, to Hendricks and to talking about volitional capacity. If the appellate court had simply put a line in the case about it, then we wouldn't be here. But they didn't, and I see that we're into rebuttal time. With your permission, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
May it please the Court.
Ms. Cohn.
Counsel. I mean, Honor, first let me start off by saying that I believe opposing counsel has a serious misunderstanding of our argument. Our argument below to the district court and to this court was is that petitioner failed to raise this claim at all. That is why the Illinois Appellate Court did not address it, because he did not raise it. He did not raise it.
That's such an extreme argument. He does talk about Hendricks as a U.S. Supreme Court case about mental disorder, about capacity control. It's in the reply brief. There are all these things we've been talking about. That may not be enough. Maybe it's not as elaborated. But this is not a case, as we've seen many cases, where somebody just comes along, finally, with decent lawyers, with a theory that will work. It's here.
Well, I respectfully disagree. And
what, Hendricks isn't
one?
Here? I mean, I've looked at the brief. It's there
it's
in the paragraph.
It's
not
Hendricks.
Mm-hmm.
It's
that Hendricks once. That's all it's
done. It's
on
the proposition that it cites Hendricks.
No, it cites Hendricks. It cites Hendricks, and then has three different paragraphs following it up.
No, it cites
Hendricks. We have the brief right here.
Does not give the full cite, and yet does not even give the complete argument with regard to the constitutionality of the SDP.
It's no surprise that a pro se person does not give the argument that took the justices of the Supreme Court more than 50 pages to spell out in Hendricks. That's one reason why we use citations.
Well, Your Honor, if you just go through the reply brief, just that section, it would be claim two. The title of his claim does not reference the constitutionality of the act,
virtual
control, or lack of control.
That's a different point.
But you have to take the whole claim together. So when the appellate court was looking at this claim, it was buried on the third page of that claim. How would he be able to clearly figure out basically that it was that claim was presented? The claim that petitioner is saying that the sexually dangerous person acts unconstitutional, it just is not evident.
Yeah, that language is not there. But there is some discussion about the volitional issue in the context of the argument he's making. That's the point. You would concede that.
The only time that there is some language about a lack of control is on the bottom of page 6, B008, which is in the separate appendix. It's just on the bottom, that is it. He just cites the Hendricks, but if you read it right before, he's talking about psychiatric testimony, whether the psychiatrists are even allowed to testify with regard to different disorders and so forth. Right after that, on the next page, it does not go further into a lack of control or a lack of volitional control. Again, it goes into antisocial personality disorders and where the psychiatrist may not have properly found him to have an antisocial personality disorder. Moreover, the conclusion of the reply brief does not mention Hendricks, does not mention a lack of volitional control. In fact, the conclusion appears to mention a reasonable doubt argument. So it's certainly not fairly presented to the appellate court. That's why they never addressed it, because they could not, you just can't see that it is a constitutionality of the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act claim. More so,
is there any particular reason why we are fighting over this? And why are we fighting in the year 2004 about the adequacy of a hearing held in 1999? And decisions like this are supposed to be subject to periodic review. You can't hold a guy forever because he had a mental disorder in 1999. Why doesn't the state have another periodic review and track this down?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, you do have periodic reviews, and obviously petitioner could have taken that option during his periodic review to ask for a discharge and so forth. He didn't. He chose to file a habeas petition. He chose at that time to allege the constitutionality of the act, and I believe this court did mention that he filed a motion basically stating, you know, the constitutionally challenge to the SDP Act, but he withdrew that motion.
He talking about his
not a choice for default.
It's a little fanciful in some ways, because he seems, even on the testimony of his psychiatrist, to be somebody with some significant limitations in his ability to make choices, whether it's his grandiose or antisocial or whichever other well, I know that about that. That's not about choices. What the other personality disorders call into some question, not to mention reading his briefs, which show a rather scattered mental organization. But so the state's just waiting for him to make a motion to have his condition reevaluated?
Well, Your Honor,
I thought the law required periodic evaluations.
The law
anyway.
Does require periodic evaluations, and I believe he may be undergoing a periodic evaluation. I don't know
so
what the status of his
what
commitment.
What that means, periodic evaluations, how frequently they have to be made. Is it on some kind of cycle?
It is on some kind of cycle.
What is the cycle?
For, Your Honor, with the SDP, I'm not exactly sure because the Attorney General's Office does not handle SDP petitions primarily. We handle SVP petitions, Sexually Violent Persons Act. But the two acts are comparable. And I do know with an SVP petition, you have an initial six-month evaluation once you're committed. Then you have annual evaluations.
Every year.
Every
so
year.
Probably.
When
is the last time he had one?
His counsel may be better able to answer
that.
But also with SVP petitions.
Litigation to one side. When the state does these annual evaluations, does it now apply the Hendricks and Crane standards to these?
No, Your Honor. That would be post-commitment. This is primarily pre-commitment. When the court would do these evaluations,
no,
they would...
No, he's committed.
Permissible. He is committed
at this
point.
You mean post-conviction? Your theory is that...
Post-commitment. He's committed now. He's
what is it in Hendricks and Crane that says you get to continue holding somebody in violation of the standards of the U.S. Supreme Court? What if there were some new medication that gives him the ability to control himself, even though maybe he'll be a pedophile the rest of his life?
Well, Your Honor,
why do you think you don't have the obligation to continue your custody under constitutional standards?
Well, Your Honor, in that instance, if there was some medication that would control one's urges, I am sure that would be brought out. I mean,
well, but the
during a regular evaluation.
How could it be if you don't think you have to ask the question about control as opposed to inherent psychological condition?
I think you may be assuming that once they're committed, they're just locked up and that's it.
That's
no.
What you said, not me. You
no,
said,
no.
You
I
told Judge Easterbrook you weren't applying Hendricks or Crane to the periodic evaluations, and I'm
no,
fine.
But no. What I may have misspoken. What I am saying is the periodic evaluations, the psychiatrist will take into consideration his therapy, what he's gone through, how various, whether it's physical therapy, whether it's group therapy and so forth, how much he's improved. And I believe under the SDP Act, I know with the SVP Act, a petitioner on his own can also petition for conditional release.
And is he
can
entitled to counsel when he goes through this process?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is he entitled to counsel when he goes through this process?
He can request counsel. I don't believe it's mandatory. I believe it's up to the discretion of the judge whether to appoint counsel.
But we all agree that he's not asked for any judicial activity since 1999.
I believe he has.
Even before then.
I believe he hasn't. I'm not sure what you mean by judicial activity.
Any of the hearings to which he's entitled, right?
You know what?
You say there are administrative reviews annually, and presumably at the end of that administrative review, he might file a proceeding saying, I no longer meet the criteria for this.
Absolutely.
But at least you say he's never done the latter. He may have had annual reviews, but he's never filed a proceeding.
To the best of my knowledge, I don't know if he's asked for any reviews with regard to his SDP commitments.
And we are left in a state of uncertainty about what the state thinks it's doing in its administrative proceedings.
Right. So this hearing is only triggered when he asks? I just want to get, because it wasn't clear, you said you didn't think he had asked. So this periodic review doesn't take place unless someone asks?
No, the periodic review, and again, I just want to clarify, I'm not too sure about the SDP Act, but with the SVP Act, you have two options. You will have an initial six-month evaluation, then a yearly evaluation.
Right.
And I'm assuming both acts are similar. But in addition, you can also ask for conditional release. You can petition
but wait a
for
minute, wait a minute. On this yearly, this is something automatic?
Automatic,
this
absolutely.
This is not something that the detainee has to request?
No. And that's, again, with SCP. You will get annual evaluation.
It sounds like the kind of thing a state would do because it doesn't want to pay the cost of providing housing and care.
That's not true.
In the state's interest, perhaps, rather than the detainees.
Actually, Your Honor, the reason why the SCP Act was enacted,
I
so we could help
these
individuals.
These acronyms leave me completely befuddled. If you would actually use the names, it would help me a lot.
The Sexually Dangerous Persons Act, the reason why that was enacted was to help these individuals and to get them treatment. And that's what he's going through now. He may refuse treatment. I don't know if he's refusing treatment and taking the course of filing a habeas petition. That I don't know. But these acts provide an individual, in this instance, get treatment. I believe my time is up. I would just like to conclude by saying
thank you.
I request that you affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Deckler, you must have about 45 seconds left.
Your Honor, first, I'd like to apologize about not catching the Baldwin case and request the opportunity, 14 days, to brief this issue with respect to Baldwin.
All right. We'll give you 10 days.
10 days? Thank you, Your Honor. As far as I understand, and this is not in the record, but Your Honor seemed interested about how often he is reviewed. It is my understanding from Mr. Ambrose that unless he admits that he is guilty...
Parties can file simultaneously within 10 days. Okay. Sorry to interrupt you.
No problem, Your Honor. Unless he admits that he is guilty of the crime for which he is accused, he is ineligible for treatment and therefore ineligible for release. He can't even get into a group setting where treatment would begin to occur. And as Mr. Ambrose individually maintains his innocence of the crimes for which he was found guilty in the civil proceeding, he has not been reviewed according to him. That's not in the record, but I thought Your Honors may be interested. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. We want to thank you and your firm for your willingness to undertake the appointment in this case. The assistance you've been both to your client and to the court. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.